So good evening, everyone, and tonight we're back on, it's HCM Revisited, and we're working our way through The Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus by E.J. Gold. And we've worked our way through a number of chapters, and we're now all the way to chapter 13. We're roughly halfway through the book, and this chapter is entitled Help. We have posted, in a certain way, the two primary pillars in this work that is being presented by EJ to us. And the one way to begin to look at it, and it's going to be important as we go through this chapter, is that we have a human biological machine, and that is made up of a physical centrum, a mental centrum, an emotional centrum. That's who we are. That's us, so to speak. And that is, a couple of chapters ago, we started looking at it in terms of that this is an electrical body. So we had the exercise of viewing that as an electrical body rather than just a physical thing that we interact with, that we are. And then last chapter, we were introduced to the concept that there's an essential self, which is a distinct, and it's a different electrical body. And those two electrical bodies interact. And in a sense, and Silverdale commented, or help me if on this one, but it's almost the portal between the two is the action of attention. We bring our attention to the game. And that's what we can bring to this party. And it's working in that manner, working with our attention. I don't care what level you're at, what you do, or how you work. At the next moment, when you bring forth that attention, that's your work at that moment. And that's what we're going to be introduced to a little bit here in Chapter 13. It's help. And we're going to look at, well, what does the concept of help mean? So, M.A., my partner for the last few weeks, is, won't be able to make it tonight. So I think, Mike, are you online? Are you on the phone?
Yeah, I'm out here.
Okay, good. Would you mind reading the header for us to get us started on Chapter 13?
Sure, I'll read that.
Good.
Real help is not someone doing something for us or a lessening of our personal suffering and struggles. Real help has no calming effect. Quite the contrary. It makes the machine squirm itself into evolution by reflex.
So evolution by reflex, squirm into. So underline that. Write it on a post-it somewhere. Post it on your refrigerator, on your the mirror in your bathroom. Keep that phrase around. We don't quite know what it means yet, but let's just say it's another revelation to help us see how this process and this interplay, this wonderful interplay between the essential self and the human biological machine, how it creates the portal for transformation. Mike, if you would, if you see something that we should be reading out loud, I'd appreciate it if you just jump in whenever you want, all right?
Okay, and Silverdale, you know, help me out.
Okay, Mike, I sure will.
And I know it's not an easy job as we're going through the material and trying to keep attention on that, but I don't have a computer screen nearby. So let's just jump into it. We have such high, wonderful ideas, such complicated, exalted, psychological, philosophic explanations, such noble intentions for ourselves. Then all of a sudden, in spite of our best intentions and our strongest wishes, things go wrong and we sink into deep, dark, negative states. From the depths of the volcano of the deep self, an explosion erupts, destroying all our noble dreams and illusions in its wake. What became of our high ideals and noble intentions at that moment? We're the same package, right? We've all had that, whether it's the explosion. I mean, the easiest one that everybody likes to point to is, oh, you got angry and you had an explosion. It's just as, quote-unquote, explosive when someone shuts down through depression or self-pity or goes totally quiet. It's the same thing. It's the machine has taken over at that moment. So we're trying to find our way to a different, little bit of a different path here. Deep down in the darkest, most primitive levels of the machine, someone or something, the most inaccessible part of ourselves, makes it impossible for us to actually carry out our highest aims and aspirations. Think of that. The will of the machine towards self-gratification and sleep is very different from the high ideals of the essential self, which has truly marvelous plans. Periodic emotional storms constantly serve as reminders that the machine has a will of its own. We have to have some groundwork. We have to do some work here. We have to gather our own data. We have to learn to observe our machine. And we have to have the habit of doing that. The habit of doing anything, I don't care what field you're in or what you do, whether it's dog grooming or it's large machine construction work, it's subtle work, maybe you're a musician, whatever it is, you have to do it over and over and over again to create the new habit, the clarity of the new habit that you can then bring to what you want to do. It's the same with observing the machine. After a while, when you actually you start to work and this becomes part of your nature to observe your machine, when certain sleep states hit you, it'll surprise you and it'll actually act as a reminding factor to awaken the machine. How does that work? You'll notice the state come on. You'll notice the facial muscles change. You'll notice your posture change in whatever way it is for you. And that'll be the reminding factor that brings forth a particular kind of attention. You'll be surprised that the machine has fallen into that sleep state. Okay? But it takes a little while to get there, but it's doable. The essential self with its great ideals is unfortunately not the director of the machine, and under ordinary circumstances can never be the director of the machine or anything else. As it is, the essential self is a slave, not a master, yet it was made to be master. So we have this strange terminology of slave and master. We talked about that before in the last chapter, where we had the attention of the essential self, or the essential self like glued in a certain way to the human biological machine and attempting to separate itself. And that's where we are now. Okay, our biggest lie about ourselves, besides the absurd idea that man is not just another species of primate belonging to the animal kingdom, is that the essential self is the director, almost the absolute autocrat. That's the absurd idea we have. We can see clearly from our daily activities that that's not the case. The machine exercises its destructive will, completely disregarding the intentions of the essential self. This conflict gives the illusion of many different identities, each acting on its own. And we're reminded of the Gurdjieffian ideas of, you know, there are many masters, there are, you know, many eyes, and so on and so forth. What we're talking about now is, is there a way to create unification? Is there a way to create a unified expression going forward? Let's see. Really, there are only two. The machine exercises destructive will, completely disregarding the intentions of the essential self. This conflict gives the illusion of many different identities, each acting on its own. Really, there are only two identities, the intelligence, which formulates higher aims and aspirations, and the primitive brain, which is the real director of the machine, because its savage will is completely dominant. We are in the grip of the machine's private insanity. So the intelligence, by here, it's not meant that's not meant by our mental chatter. But most of what we call thinking is just associative. You associate one idea with the next idea that comes to you. And the next idea that comes, and suddenly you might be 360 or 180 degrees away from your thought pattern just because that's where association has led us. But intelligence means you assert the will of the attention to think and consider an idea. So that's what we're starting to think about, these higher levels of work that we might be able to do. So, yet we tell ourselves the lie that the mental apparatus is the director of the machine. Originally, the meaning of virtue was that noble aims and aspirations of the essential self had reached down to the mental apparatus and rooted itself into the deepest part of the machine, and that the aims and aspirations of the deepest, darkest part of the machine had in fact become the same as those of the essential self. In our beginning work, we first encounter the idea that we are expected to apply a method, some technique unknown to us in ordinary life, which can somehow help us to penetrate through to the deepest, darkest part of the machine and plant our ideals in it. Our ideals become incarnate reality in flesh and blood. At least we are one with the machine, in this sense, at least. I'm jumping ahead a little bit. We can refuse to acknowledge our total lack of will over the machine and pointedly ignore the inner emotional storms and external upheavals caused by the machine against all our higher intentions. The second choice we have is to lower our standards. And up above, he was saying that we have three choices as we begin to study the machine. We can ignore what we see. We can lower our standards of ideal. The third choice is the most difficult. We can search for a method, a practical means by which the machine is brought to a state which actually reflects the higher ideals of our essential self in the deepest fibers. So that starts to be the heart of this chapter right there. We can search for a method of practical means by which the machine is brought to a state which actually reflects the highest ideals of our essential self in the deepest fibers of its being. Any thoughts on that?
David?
Yeah.
This is Sandra.
Yeah, hi there.
I just happened to read Struggle of the Sorcerers and Quoth today. And this chapter is just about what you're talking about. And the exercises in that chapter, you ask if there was a method, indicate that one ought to do the opposite of what the machine wants to do. And he gives a list of things that you can do. And that would be the method.
Well, and we have to be careful of all of those, and that's why we want to bring our work back to our work buddies, and we want to test our work in a sense. Because first of all, let me put it in context. What Sandra is talking about is the book Practical Work on Self, and I don't remember the chapter number, but it's a chapter, The Struggle of the Sorcerers. And there's this struggle between these two parts of us, and intentionality and just operating from reactivity. So one thing is, when you tend to do something, try doing something opposite. But the key here is that should not also become a mechanical thing. Just because you do something, don't force yourself suddenly, I got to do something opposite. Do it with intention. Do it with intention. So that's a particular, the whole, you should read Practical Work on Self. I mean, many of you have, I know that. That's a whole set of exercises to do things. But that's a good one, Sandra. Very good.
Yes, because he's talking about fragmentary identities and how things get scattered all over the body, and that's why we're not integrated.
Yeah, and what about anybody else on that particular point, this idea of integrating our higher ideals? We all have these higher ideals. We're inspired by things. We get inspired. And we want to have that, and then suddenly we can't get back to it. We can't get back to where we want to be on that. What happens there? Well, in my opinion, part a lot of it is you have to practice. Practice and any way you can, in any environment that you can get to, you'll be in many environments. And in those environments, bring these ideals forth with yourself. Bring them forth and make them part of your, I'm going to say, ordinary life, so that the ideals become something that you work with. One of the things that everybody here has been around the block quite a bit, and I suggest that one way that we can help each other in this group is take the experiments that you do during the week and bring them back and share on a Wednesday for the others that are here. They'll be able to get something from that. It enlivens what they'll be doing that their following week. When you share something like, you know, Sandra's sharing, and maybe she's doing that exercise, and if you share it in a certain way, others can see a way through it. You can
David,
see. I can do that. Yes, go ahead, Mike.
Sinhal sort of shared something like that. He says, I'm currently quitting cigarettes cold turkey. It gives a great opportunity for observation of struggle in oneself.
Yeah, so we'd be, there's two sides to this. One is we encourage you and we stand with you in your efforts to quit that particular physical habit of smoking. But we're also, I'm very interested to see what you find out in the next week or two. What do you see the machine doing? How does it operate? And when you, I mean, we've all been through some addictive force of some sort that we've attempted to work with, and some we were able to work with and go beyond. Let's see what happens. You know, you get a whiff of a cigarette as you're walking down the street. What does that invoke? And it's not a simple physical act. This is a difficult thing because it's going to invoke, the act of smoking invokes certain moods as well. And a lot of that is what you're actually, that's part of what the actual, you know, addiction is to the mood. It has its physical consequences as well.
You know, David, I'll tell you, I prefer to write out my answers rather than share them out loud.
That's okay, good.
But tonight I'll just say, you know, in my experience, one of the things I found most impressive in this chapter is that it takes for granted that we have an essential self, and that the condition of this essential self that is within all of us is in a very weak condition. So in trying to explain that to myself, and then it also makes the point that our body, our human biological machine, is a dominant force. And it's because of the dominance of the force of our physical, of our human biological machine, that we can't really get in touch with our essential self. Well, anyway, starting from that, in my own work efforts, I gradually developed the idea, well, the only way you can identify an essential self within yourself is if you're able to pacify the human biological machine, mostly through observation. That is, over a fairly long period of time, see how it does dominate things, and through that gradual pacification, you gradually actually do begin to perceive that essential self, and the idea is to get that essential self to grow to a position of dominance in which it is saturating the physical body with vibratory sensations of one kind or another. And then
right.
That's, of course, the work of many years.
And that's the work, and many of us have been doing that, however we've been doing that, and we need to continue. But what we'll see is, in a sense, when the human biological machine, through the effort of attention, is pacified and its dominant will is lowered, pacified, then the essential self, in a sense, has thrown off its shackles.
Mm-hmm.
It's thrown off its shackles, and that for the first time, and it's not the first time, but it can now look around, and it's looking with those fresh eyes, and that is the heart of creativity. That is,
yep,
from the beautiful heart of chaos, as I put it, comes forth those sets of eyes, and those eyes are the eyes that can get us to the next. That's where our direction will be set.
David, I have an exercise that I use to get me there, if you'd like to hear it.
Sure.
I learned how to do this on my own when I was 14 years old. It just came to me. I adopt a mood. You could call it reverence or sacredness or something like that. I slow myself down. And I find something to do with my hands, and I do it very carefully and very slowly and with deep attention, and I'm awake. And that really pacifies me and puts me into a very, pacific state.
When we are in a position where we have no hope, there's nothing we can do, we don't know how to proceed, we're in a confused state, we're in high anxiety, and we, in a sense, are locked there. One thing we can always do is that exact exercise, and that exact exercise is to literally watch the physical body in any way you can. So the next time that you are in high anxiety, let's say that you've just found out that your bank account is overdrawn, you don't know what to do, we don't know how it happened, you don't know any of that, and there it is, and you're moving rapidly, you're talking fast, your brain is just about to explode. You can still go to it, the awakened machine, by observing, having the will to observe the physical movement of the machine, anything that works for you, your hand, your foot, just anything. And you just place your attention on that, and that whole cycle of drama. Sometimes you need such drama, by the way, but that whole cycle of drama is pacified. Great exercise. Very, very good. So, jumping ahead just a little bit, an awakened machine cannot possess negative force, and since negative force provides the force for the exertion of its will, an awakened machine has no will of its own. Without the force of its will, the machine comes to a standstill. And here's the critical thing. When the machine is awake, even the subtle suggestions of the essential self, which has no weapon but attention, is sufficient to direct the machine. Okay? That's where we are. That's only when we can make that effort can our direction come from our higher self. As we develop our higher self and we're more comfortable living in that position, we understand that ultimately, and this is a long ways down the road, but that is the heart of the labyrinth. This is the will of the Absolute coming through us. But we can't even get out some pacification of this dominant will of the machine, but we can do it at any time. At any time. Practice. And, you know, and then the first sentence, there's no way to fight to direct the machine directly. Of course not. It's like stopping, you know, a railroad train with your hands. There's no method of training and drilling the machine to conform. That's a vain effort. It's a vain effort to do that. Though that's what a lot of methodology is, oh, I'll do this and suddenly I will be different. You've seen people and they say, oh, I'll learn dance really well and then I'll be different. I'll learn singing really well, then I'll be different. Uh-uh. The being different part means that it's the essential self that starts to become the leader. We can have the best intentions in the world, the best aesthetics, the most marvelous plans for ourselves, yet if the machine continues to behave monstrously, all our plans will come to nothing, all our high ideals will be useless. People like that, you know, they're highly skilled, they're this and that, and then you get to know them and they have these phenomenal, you know, character defects. Well, I wonder why. So, now we move forward. We must accomplish two things. One, we must find some way to define, delineate, clarify what are our exact ideals. Secondly, we must see that we do not have the will to bring the entire machine into action as a unified whole. Okay? The next sentence is, then when we formulate an aim, and in practical work on self, you'll see a number of chapters regarding the formulation of aim. And it's only when we breathe through the essential self, when we breathe from that place, can we begin to see what an aim might be. And only when we see it from that place can we begin to posit it into the life of the actual machine. Then it's an interior methodology, not exterior. If the machine has no will of its own, we are unified and a true republic. The inner unity of higher aspirations of the essential self and the deepest, most primitive part of the machine is the real meaning of the ideal of a utopia. So we are that utopia. So we become that utopia when the essential self becomes the leader. And it's so simple. It's too simple for the human mind. I say this over and over again. Place your attention on the machine. Place your attention on it, and when the will is placated and it's pacified and it's down, it's the essential self that is there. And we do it over and over again. I am, but more than this, I have become. And this is what we're, this is what inner work is. Outer work is gaining accolades from our outer achievements. I have money, therefore I am great. And that is throughout society, that is the case. But maybe there's a difference. What we're really talking about is in inner greatness. And inner greatness doesn't come from the individual. It comes from the higher. So that, so we have to let that breathe a little bit. When we make the outer as the inner as the outer, then I and the Father, the essential self and the human biological machine are one. And in those moments, we are anointed. We are truly anointed. And our human biological machine is sanctified at that moment. When this unification starts to occur.
David?
Yes.
Simon had a little comment here. He was goes back to chapter 9. He says that chapter 9 says that our awakening state is imperfect, and even in the apparently awakened state, the will of the machine is still, he says prevalent. So I see what Simon is saying here. Before we get anointed, and it's like Sandra was talking about, you know, we take a decision to maybe do something like wash the dishes that we ordinarily wouldn't want to do, and observe the machine under the conditions of doing that. So that's like a pre, it's an exercise in watching the machine under creative tension, if you like. So I'm just trying to get some middle ground here between Silverdale was talking about, you know, the putting the tension on and waking the machine. If we can do that also while we're doing the task that Sandra was talking about, just any decision that's facing us, any task, if we just say, well, I'm going to observe the machine under the conditions of working on this task.
Yeah.
In the same way that Silverdale was talking about it. I mean, it's kind of a middle way there for me anyway. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
It makes a great deal of sense. It's what we can do every single day and every moment during that day. You know, I always bring up things like you go to work or you go to the store or you go and you're going to drive in your car tomorrow. If, you know, you're going to be in traffic or you're it's going to be bad weather, something like that. But the bottom line of it is how are you in it? Can you place your attention when the person checking you out at the store is a real jerk? They're really upset, and, oh, they're just giving you a hard time and or whatever. How are you in that moment? How are you in it? And you have the tool of observation that you can bring to it to awaken the machine a little bit at that moment. And know that when you're awakening the machine in that way at that moment, a number of things happen. It's truly magical. Even though it's a very, you think it's a very small thing. Here, I'll give you an example. I went to, where was I? I think I was in Boulder a couple months ago, and I was I don't know where all the stores are, but I found this it's called Whole Foods, and it's a big organic store. So I went there and I got some food, and I'm checking out, and the person that I'm checking out, you know, there's a long line, it was busy, everybody was, you know, it was the end of the day, you could see they were tired and all this sort of thing. And the person I was checking out with was, about two back in the line, and I noticed that she was, like, cranky and couldn't engage at all with the individuals that she was working with, and they were cranky. So I, of course, my machine wanted to, I didn't want her to be cranky. I mean, I wasn't thinking of her. I didn't care about her. I just didn't want her to be cranky to me. So I was going to beat her up a little bit or something when I got up there. But as I moved closer and closer to it, and I just, I didn't like being in that closed space anyway, so I'm watching, my machine is just, I'm watching it very carefully. And I noticed that it just calmed down and it started to breathe. I started to breathe. When I got up there and she was waiting on me, you know, she says mechanically, oh, hello, how are you, whatever it is like that. And I said, gosh, you know what, I'm really doing pretty good today. And I said, and I looked at her directly and I engaged with her. At that moment, something started to happen in her. Because you can't fight the machine head on to head on, right? But you can. Something, I was able to give her space because I gave myself space. I got out of the cycle and it created space for her to breathe in. By the time she was done, she was smiling. I wasn't, trying to make her smile. I was just trying to be in myself, so to speak.
David, we got a couple of things here I might read on the...
All righty, go ahead.
But before I read them, I just wanted to say that it's like your electrical field was influencing her, giving her the freedom to act more in accordance with her essential nature, actually. But in the checkout line there. Okay,
yeah.
So Silverdale said, the whole of this teaching boils down to continuous self-observation over many years, which leads to a gradual self-remembering by the essential self. As the essential self remembers itself, it gradually grows to have dominance within the human biological machine.
This is what, when the will of the machine is placated, the true power of what the essential self is can come to bear. And it does. It actually does. And it becomes the master at that point. It's something new happens.
By the way, I thought Ginger Rogers had a good comment as well. She says, I remember when I first learned to read stories and books by myself as a child, that was a life-saving moment for me as a way of getting free of the machine and its problems. Now it doesn't have that power, but I still have the memory of how wonderful this was. I felt free somehow. So in small successes, we gradually find our freedom.
Well, when she was little and she found out about what an important thing reading was, what it imprinted, and this is important too, it imprinted in her essential self the path to get out of the dominance of the machine at that moment.
Yep.
She knew it with high clarity, and she could see, this is how I get out. This is my escape route to inner freedom. And that memory is forever. That level of memory is forever. But whether the reading does it anymore or not, the point of it is that the path is there. Very nice. Thank you for you guys for sharing that one. So we want to become one. It must be clearly understood that the work, now we have this with a big W, cannot be studied through the sleeping machine. The work means nothing to the sleeping machine. A sleeping machine is hypnotized by its own subjective fixations. It is deaf and blind to the work, even to the higher ideals, because it is asleep. The work cannot be defined because it is a living, growing, and changing. The word living once was the same as the word awake. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that feel right to you? When you're awake, you're more alive. The essential self has no will except the will of attention. It can place its attention on something. It can direct its attention. Now, here's my favorite, and this is knocked me out when I first read this 20-plus years ago. By bathing the machine in its attention, it awakens the machine. It's pure poetry for me. Because that's exactly how it feels for me. When I place my attention on it, it's as if I'm bathing the machine. Like just a splash of cool, clear water bathing the machine. And the machine then is placated, but it has a chance to do what its will, what its function is. Its function is to serve the essential self. Okay? The force of the attention of the essential self is slow and subtle, like the tortoise. The machine's attention is like the rabbit, rapidly darting this way and that. The subtle force of attention is our only weapon against sleep, but it is a very effective weapon if we are able to see that because it is subtle. It must be applied unremittingly, unwaveringly, over a very long period of time. And that's just what we heard Silverdale tell us. Long period of time. And Sinhog, you're going through an effort. And it'll be whatever effort it is, but one of your biggest tools that you have, not the force of will of the machine, but the subtle attention of the essential self. Unremitting. Unremitting.
David Silverdale made a comment. He said, I've described the human biological machine as a womb within which the essential self can grow, if done so consciously, intentionally, voluntarily, and intelligently.
So we have a birthplace, and it's the labor efforts that start to become, to launch and to hatch the essential self. So many traditions have the show the concept of the essential self, you know, the soul being birthed, or they note it as an egg being birthed. And that's throughout mythology, you're going to see that. The birth event that occurs. Well, we have a chance to birth ourselves. And we are creating our soul. And it's through this kind of effort that that occurs. The subtle but unremitting attention on our machine. What a cool thing to do, right? It's neat. If we refuse work, we refuse help. Work is help. If we want real help and not our imaginary ideas of what help is, we must accept it in the form it comes, not in the form we expect. Real help is not someone doing something for us or a lessening of our personal struggles. Jumping ahead, it is important to recognize the consequence of asking for real help. If we want calming, we should ask for calming. If we want real help, we must ask for real help and understand when it is given. We may not like the results, but real results will make the machine squirm. No pain, no gain. We must develop a definite courage to ask for help because we may actually get what we ask for. Humility is also necessary. We must be able to recognize that we are not capable of helping ourselves. Then, in addition, we must develop stamina, fortitude to survive that hell. Purity and virtue help us place ourselves in a situation in which help can be given. What virtue really means is that the mind and the machine are one, in the sense that what the mind conceives, the machine achieves. And we are then heading towards unity and becoming a unified field at that time. And as you know, I often quote Spinoza, and he says, it's this effort at understanding that is virtue itself. So the process, the dynamic process at that moment of placing, washing your machine with your attention, bathing it with it, that moment is the moment of virtue right then and right there. Let's talk about help in a number of ways. There is a quote from Goethe that I'll try to remember to bring next time about help. But you call forth from the universe, and the universe will answer if you're asking for help from a true place within you. It will respond. And I say to everyone here tonight and everyone that will be listening to this recording at some time, ask for help. Every time we have a class, you have the ability to ask for help. Ask for help, and in this state, that help will come from the collective essential selves that are assembled as one body.
Dave, I just wrote a comment. I'll read my own comment,
okay,
which is I think that just being present at a session like tonight is a request for help. Isn't that why we're here tonight? Not only to learn from one another, but in a sense, it's the yearning to be helped by participation.
It's very true. I mean, everybody's busy, and they say, I'm so busy, I don't think I can do it. And that you wind up coming, and you go, my gosh, that was wonderful. Why was it wonderful? Because we all put in the effort together. And this is, we are helped. It's a call for help. I'm here because I'd like to be helped by this group by putting myself in a position of speaking about these ideas that are so vibrant for me. And in doing that, it gives me something. I mean, I go away and I'm just utterly delighted.
Well, and you know, David, I almost think that there are actually two classes going on here. One is our human biological machine is listening to all of this comment and learning about its dominant nature and how destructive it is. And then our essential self is present too, learning about things that it never knew about itself and is gradually being nourished in that way as well.
It is. And so we place ourselves, we put ourselves in an environment where that will occur, and it is occurring. It is occurring. This is, it's help, it is the exercise of the essential self that's happening right now, tonight, all night long, all this session that we've been on. And even when we listen later or read the chapter later, we're going to recall the sense of presence that we had during this class. It's palpable.
David?
Yes.
I have to say that I had read this book before, and I have gotten more out of this particular class than if I'd read that book a half a dozen times by myself. Just from the comments that people have made in the chat and just from your comments.
And why is that? I mean, here's an individual who's smart, reads a great deal, is intellectually very sound, yet we come to an event like this and something about it, we learn more. And what we're learning isn't so much the linear attaching together the words into the form of an English sentence, but it's rather exercising ourselves in the presence of the essential self. There's a form of understanding and data that comes to us that is not possible unless we're in that state. True for me. Definitely true for me. Big help. So how are we doing? Are we about there?
My computer says 7:59.
Okay. Well, we always go by your computer. So we'll agree that we're about there. And so we understand that this effort at understanding, these efforts at awakening the machine, that's the virtue that opens the door to us to get to the next level. So I thank you so much for coming tonight and participating in this effort together. And I look forward to you being there with me next week on Wednesday at 7 o'clock when we proceed further with HBM Revisited. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.